Morning. So we're going to do a session on reimagined organisations, and I've got three very different perspectives coming here. So we're going to look at how the organisations here have transformed in response to the pandemic, but also social justice movements. So I have got Laurie Sansom, who's Artistic Director and CEO of Northern Broadsides, Justin Lee, who is Director of Cambridge Music Festival, the wonderful Sharon Canavar, thank you very much for last night.
I'm really sorry.
Chief Executive of Paragon International.
It's all about knowing your audience, that's what I've learned.
I blame you for everything. So everyone's going to do a little bit of spiel about where they're coming from on this, and then we're going to open up to Q&A. So we'll start with Laurie, who's got an endless list of things from eco-squads, anti-racism, casting policies, eco-riders, radical changes, board recruitment, but actually what you're going to talk about is Off by For All Change Network,
yeah,
which I'm intrigued to hear about. So cool. Over to Laurie.
I feel exhausted while you just say the list, actually, but I think probably like all of us, the pandemic accelerated a lot of change that was going on in our organisations anyway. And that's Broadsides was no exception. Broadsides is 30 next year, and I kind of consider it to be almost the third organisation that somehow I've ended up leading at a period of intense change. The first being Royal and Durngate in Northampton, then the National Theatre of Scotland, and now Broadsides. I feel like we're in the middle of a really exciting process, but a very challenging one. The process during pandemic was the necessity to diversify what we were making, and it was an opportunity to change who we made it with, and it was an opportunity to change our models of production, because like Kate was speaking about earlier, Broadsides have a fiercely loyal, very particular audience up and down the country that have been fanatical about the company for 30 years, and they're largely over 55, and they're largely white, and actually there is a moral responsibility, but also a creative responsibility to shift, change how we make and what we make. So I took the company on 2 years ago, and I had the same struggles as I had in Scotland about founder syndrome, which some of you might be aware of, which is when a company's been founded by someone and you're the next person to take it on, you have a particular set of challenges about change. And I consider Scotland to be a slightly aborted attempt to initiate change. And hopefully Broadsides, I'm in the middle of something where we're making some really exciting progress that I'll share with you now. And the reason I think is that you have to pick your moment. And I ended up feeling like when I was in Scotland that I was in the middle of a transitional moment for the company, and the company wasn't ready to do a wholesale change about what they were making, how they did it. It's a much harder organisation to turn. It was £4 million from the government a year with 52 members of staff, going up to 750 people in any given year. Now, Broadsides has 3 full-time members of staff and, as you can imagine, a much smaller budget. But equal issues about founder syndrome, where there's a fierce loyalty to governing an idea. Second plug for Nina Simon of the day. Mm-hmm. This is what the book looks like. So we heard Nina speak at a CLAW leadership conference about her work. And she ran a San Diego museum, and she set herself the task of making the organisation more relevant to more people. That's the kind of her basic objective. And she's developed a network called the Of, By, For, All Change Network, which is an international cohort of 400 organisations who go through a facilitated programme every year and to make their organisations more relevant to more people. We're one of 4 British organisations who are part of the cohort this year. It cost us £2,000, but it depends on the scale of your company, what the fee is. And 10 of us regularly go on to facilitated sessions online with the other 400 companies, as well as have individual breakout sessions. And there's a structured program of change going over a year. So I've got some slides. So I'm going to do the next slide, please, thing.
It's coming to you.
Oh, I've got a thingy. Thank you. Where am I pointing it? At that? Okay. So of, by, for, all. And this is really pertinent to what we were talking about earlier. Of talks about how your company needs to be of the community you're wanting to serve. And so it's looking at the board, staff, your partners, the content, and how you make yourself truly representative. And it speaks to what we were saying earlier about, instead of making product and going, how do we get the people to come? It's about looking at the organization itself and who's within it and who are making the decisions. By is the programs, the events, the projects, the strategy. So who's then devising, creating, who's it part of that innovation funnel, who's creating the program, and then who's it for? Now, for, we're all pretty good at anyway, and we've been going through a model of making sure our work is more relevant to more people. But the of and the by is where we need to focus and what we focus on in of, by, for, all change network. So there's Nina. Now you can see what she looks like. It's an international program to develop community co-creation and co-design. So that's the work we've been going on. And a lot of the work is about how we embody equity and inclusion concepts at the heart of this change. So this is kind of a quick model that goes, first of all, community design, curiosity, asset-based thinking, radical partnership is about what you're making. And it really manages to change your thinking about how we see our communities. And instead of thinking about what do our communities need, we actually start talking about being curious about the community and seeing them as having assets already, and those assets being valuable to us. And it totally shifts around the power balance of how you start imagining the work you make. The other things here is about how you check in the impact of your work. And a lot of this is around social justice principles. So making sure that what you're doing is not causing any harm and you're not repeating institutional trauma, and then a check-in about unlearning ways of behaving that have done damage in the past is crucial to the program. So, for example, if your theatre building has in the past created work or had policies that were discriminatory or not inclusive, then there's some unlearning to be done. And it's a real challenge, I think, for companies to really look at past behaviours, past programmes, and understand that that may have created barriers to other communities joining your work. And then it's about a continuous commitment to continuous growth, so that you're continually working through this feedback cycle, so that this change is not a one-shot wonder. It's a process that you're all committed to. You have to act as if you were possible to radically transform the world, and you have to do it all the time. So there's you're challenged to go into a series of radical imaginings, and it's that fourth box, I guess, from the last model of working with your communities in radical partnerships, where there's not a judgmental process of critiquing people's ideas or viewpoints, but a generosity of spirit as we develop all those 50 innovative ideas before we find the one that suits the organisation and the community. I'm going to be swift now because I realise that I'll share these slides so everyone can see them, and you can go onto the website and find out more about the programme. We are at a point now where we're defining our community of interest, which is the third one there. And this is some of what came out of our radical imaginings. So I saw a large, diverse cast of professional and non-professional disabled, non-disabled actors as an after-show party on a rooftop garden of our building. So the radical imagining process for broadsides took us in all so many different directions. And it has led us, there's the team, hello, to this community of interest where we're focusing our work. So what's great is they make you be completely specific about who it is you're going to now work with over the next year. And this is not to say this is the only time you do it and this is the only community, but they ask you to be really specific. So we defined ours as young South Asian people, 16 to 25, with an interest in the creative industries, culture and performance, living in the most deprived wards in Calderdale, according to the Index of Multiple Deprivation 2019. Sounds a bit of a mouthful, but it actually means that we know who it is we need to work with, talk to, get on our boards. We set up an art squad, which is in parallel to our board, which is representative of so many different groups, including Park Ward, where we're focusing most of our work. And that is the beginning of our OV process. There you go. So where we're at the moment is we're transforming who is working with our company and who we're listening to in our artistic programming, but we're also now exploring where our company is based, because talking about placemaking and how a touring theatre company can actually have roots deep down its local community and how that can build ladders between the professional work, community work, and artistic development is where we're at. And we're going on this process to give ourselves a theoretical equity principles and giving us tools to work together on it. I'm going to leave it there.
Thank you, Laura. I'm sure there'll be questions in a minute, but we're going to go next to Justin, director of Cambridge Music Festival, who's going to be talking about the challenges of the pandemic and the changes that you've made in the last year. I know we've talked a bit about this, Justin, and you've got some interesting challenges that you want to tell everyone about.
So, yes, thank you. I've been the festival's in its 30th year. So it's quite an important year. It's my 10th year, and I'm sorry I haven't been able to get to this conference before, but the festival is normally in November. So I've never been able to make it here, so it's very nice to be here on my first occasion, but rather strange to be speaking at my first one. But the changes I think I brought about are probably quite simple and probably not very remarkable, but it was quite hard to do. And I think it helps if I talk a little bit about Cambridge first, just so that you get an idea. Oh, that's me. I need to remind myself occasionally. That's what that looks like. Is the context in which I'm working. So if I talk a little bit about Cambridge, or if you think, when you think of Cambridge, what do you think of? Because it's quite a famous place, albeit a rather small one. I'm guessing what two or three things might come to mind, and I'm guessing that might be one of them. So that's King's College Chapel. From the back, it's all very pretty. It's a huge building built by King. Wouldn't have got planning permission today. And if it's not that, then you might be thinking of the Nine Lessons and Carols. These cute boys, little angels, I'm sure, in their starched Eton collars. And when they're not wearing those, they wear gowns and top hats. So it's all... and I could show you many pictures of historical buildings and green spaces, and it's all lovely and very beautiful. And when the sun shines a bit more than it normally does, or for a bit longer than usual, then picture editors across the country will scratch their heads and think, what should we put on our front pages? And utterly predictable, but it happens every single time. You may not notice that, but... I can't remember what the next slide is, but I think it might be that if you have an imaginative photographer... they put the two together, so it's a really strange place. So it's this beautiful place, famous for its history, but also its innovation because it's a centre for high tech industry and so on, the Silicon Fen, so called. It comes high up in surveys and wins awards and all the rest of it. And one survey by the Centre for Cities. In 2017 and again in 2018, Cambridge came top. You know, it's a wonderful thing, except that it was for inequality. And that is the thing, is you get this astonishing wealth and areas of deprivation, particularly to the north and eastern sides of the city centre. If you know the city, King's Hedges, Arbury and the Abbey wards. And that's the thing about Cambridge, is it has a public perception. And then there's a reality, and there are these contradictions that run through it. And it's quite a fragmented place. So you have the city versus, as it were, the university. You have this wealth versus the sort of the disadvantage, and so on. And it's, if you like, the tradition versus the innovation, which is the two sides. But it's a fragmented place, for historical reasons, everyone ploughs their own furrow, and it's really hard to collaborate. And so what I was trying to do, I mean, just to give you an idea of ploughing your own furrow, the music industry, the music business, the classical events, which is predominantly what I do, there are two universities. The older one has 31 colleges. Each of them has a music society for student music. Some of them have chapels with chapel choirs. Many of them have chapels. Some of them have good chapel choirs. There are music societies bringing in professional musicians. There's Cambridge University Musical Society that has 500 students all performing music across 10 ensembles from, you know, conventional to wacky, giving about 40 concerts a year. And so it goes on. You have your amateur orchestras and choirs. It's a thriving, vibrant musical life, but there's masses going on. And it's really hard to cut through that or to rise your head above the general noise. And so when I started with the festival in 2012, I was really trying to think, how can I cut through that noise, but also how can I serve not two communities, because there are more than two communities, but not just be for the standard classical audience, which I guess is older, whiter, and so on, like me, if we're honest. And so putting on the concerts is fine, particularly the more conventional ones. But when I was trying to work with the community in those areas of King's Hedges, Arbury, and the Abbey Wards, I really wanted the ideas to come from them. I think it's the point that Laurie was making just now, is you work from the assets that they have, and you start with the stories that they have to tell and see where that leads you. So I tried doing that, and there are lots of community arts organisations, and I tried working with some of them, and I think we made some progress, but it was stuttering and awkward. Also, once I was about two, three, I suppose at this time there are also certain musical issues that I want to address, like the music of women composers, more diverse performers, and the music of more diverse composers, and that's something I worked on. I can talk a little bit more about that later if you like. But it was really trying to work with those communities. But there were other things going on, which was that my audience didn't behave like a festival audience. It just looked at the events and said, well, I'll go to that. And we did various marketing initiatives, pricing, all sorts of different things to try and get people to immerse themselves, which is, I think, what you're meant to do in a festival. And it's meant to be a kind of celebration and so on. And I just couldn't get people to do that. So I suggested that we loosen the festival. Let's not get locked into it being at a specific time of year, concentrated period. And I went further and I said, do we need brochures? Do we need programs? Do we need all sorts of things? So I started to question those things. And the answers from my board, generally, and my volunteers and my audience surveys, including a couple of focus groups, came back, no, that's how it needs to be. And I didn't have the data to support it, but my instinct was that was wrong, or not completely right. COVID comes along, all of that gets swept away. Doesn't matter if it's not in November. You can spread it out as much as you like. Why would you have a brochure? It's only going to change next week or the week after. Buying online is absolutely fine. Giving the information online, that's fine. Before, my ticket sales online were 50%. Now, well, yes, it's got to be 100%. And it's completely transformed what we do, just with those small sort of technical changes. So that this year, for example, lockdown, the third lockdown ended, I think, on the 17th of May. We went on sale 2 days later for events throughout June. Just tried them. We spread them out. We had no idea whether people were ready to come back. We just try it. Because, again, it's my... I shouldn't say this to people who are data-driven solely, but data doesn't tell you everything sometimes, and people say things in surveys that they wouldn't actually do in real life, and so that's what I wanted to test. We sold out our concerts in June. We sold out all the events from September to last week. It's not many, so what is it, 14, 15 events. I also did about 11 films and commissioned 9 new pieces for this anniversary year. I can talk a bit about that later if you like, but just to give you a sense of the way things changed, is that resistance to change has gone. Income is up, even though in June, as I was saying to some people yesterday, our attendance, our capacity was 40%. And in because of COVID and social distancing and wearing masks and all the track and trace and all the stuff we did that month. And then we did a slightly sort of softer social distancing in the autumn. So that was equivalent to about 70%, 65, 70%. So that's where you have a spare seat either side of each booking. That's the point there is not reducing distance, about reducing viral load in the venue. So then you're working on ventilation and all sorts of other things, and you're asking people to wear masks. People, by and large, did do that. So it's been really positive, to the point now that we are able to put some more events on in February. And that is all going to be around a community project we're doing, which we'd hoped would be last week, but we couldn't pull together, or at least we wanted to project it. It's a sound light production on the side of the Senate House, which is the main university building where they confer degrees. The universities move rather more slowly, and so it wasn't possible to do that last week. It's unfortunate because it had a climate theme, and I don't know if you noticed, there was some stuff about climate in the news last week. So not to worry, I think climate will still be an issue next February. So we're going to do that, but it's essentially, some of this may change, but we'll never go back to the way we were in 2019. It's strengthened our financial position, it's loosened up what we can do artistically, and in community terms, it's made things possible, and people are now willing to collaborate in a way they didn't. This project in February wouldn't have happened without the involvement of three other parties in the city. So I just saw a chink, a sort of a I don't know, in sport sometimes you just have to see that little gap and go through it, and I felt that this was that gap, and I had to push now, because if I didn't make the changes now, it would be much harder in a year or two's time. So in a year or two's time, we might be asking ourselves as a board, as an organisation, are we still a festival? This may be my last conference. but to me, what's more important, you know, it's not the name of the organisation, it's not when in the year it takes place, it's what you do and why you do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse. Now I'm going to go to Sharon to have a completely different perspective on the whole thing as well. Thank you.
This is like therapy for me. I should say before I start, having taken you all out last night and then bought the shots, that we have a we have a crime writing festival, and every single year there's an author that's gone out for entertainment and then has to go on stage the very next day looking very green. Today I am that author and I'm channeling them. So. As you all know, festivals are constantly reimagining. It's been great to hear so many stories across the last day or so about the great work that everybody's been doing. You know, artists, development, balanced against the realities and the practicalities of having enough people, enough money to make those changes and do the job. We've all been through a time of reimagining families, individuals, homes. God, that PGC looked attractive this time last year. Overlay that against an organisation like ours that is really cyclical. We've got many different festivals with very distinct audiences that take place across the year. When do we open our doors? Is it for our core classical audience? Is it for our crime writing audience? It's a challenge in terms of our comms there. HIF, in any normal year, we run 150 events. We deliver large-scale outdoor work, a host of literature events, including the Theakston's Crime Awards. We sell 1,500 bedrooms in Harrogate directly through the Harrogate Festival Office. 100,000 people, 33,000 tickets, again, through the Festival Office and our box office, with a further 70,000 through our free-to-access events. The HIF team, it's not unlike many of you, went from 12 to 3, 6 live festivals and a host of year-round events, to digital with absolutely no experience, no platform, but a host of DAT tapes from the last 10 years under a desk. In March 20, we created HIF Player. We hosted all our archive events, commissioned new work. We wanted to keep the artists in business. We were really keen to make sure that there was going to be an industry on the other side. We had weekly podcasts. We work in partnership with our publishing partners to launch events, commissioned new works for people to perform at home and come together to play, and got people to animate their streets with their own artwork, with a view from their window, and create 10-word stories about the town, which we lit up buildings with. It was meant to be a holdover the summer. We're going to be back in business by autumn 20, but how naive we were. We lost 95% of our income, and the constant reimagining of events was exhausting for all of us. On the flip side, we've charted across the world. We've reached audiences we couldn't have dreamed of, and our community engagements from dance brass bands on open-top buses to lighting up buildings with literary quotes was really important. We delivered packages to elderly audiences, set up food parcels in partnerships with local schools, and kept in touch with the most vulnerable in our community. Decisions similar to you that would have taken years to turn around were taken without question, And our challenge now is how can our festivals survive for the future? Monetizing our digital offer remains a dream. Arts Council funds often remain out of reach. And trying to understand really what the impact has meant on an organization like ours, what does that mean for the future? And the challenges should not be underestimated, and there is no quick fix. Now, I spent the last few weeks wondering if we did the wrong thing. There's lots of organizations who went dark right across the north of England. At the time, we looked down at them and thought, God, how foolish. We've got something to do here. We need to be working with our community. We need to be helping them. We need to be doing more. We need to be creative, agile, make change, make a difference. And I'm looking at them now, looking like they've had quite a restful time over the last 12 months with funding that they've got in their back pocket and a team that's ready to go. They've recruited, they know what they're going to do, and they've spent that time strategizing. And quite frankly, I'm quite jealous about that. And the challenge for me now and for my board and my team is how do we build going forward? We've opened the doors, and I'm quite surprised how many of my audience just think we're just going to be straight back to normal, and the program and annual season of events across each and every month will just be exactly the same as it was, and that's not going to be the case. And our challenge now is how we balance creating a team to do some of the backroom stuff and the strategizing and using all our data to make plans for the future, meanwhile having to deliver something which is the right thing to do this year, and how we keep that comms really clear that if we do go back to delivering a classical music festival across weekends in July, is that what we should be doing this year when it could be only a one-off because we might decide that's not something that comes back in the future? I've got a host of jobs that I'm currently recruiting for. If anyone wants to move to Harrogate, it's very lovely. with skills that I might not even need in 12 months' time. So there's some real balances and challenges there going forward. So, and that's something that we're wrestling with as an organisation. The balance between appeasing our audiences, creating bold new work, creating a resilient organisation for the future that's, a festival that is 21st century ready with all the challenges that we've just had. I'm confident we can do it. We're a pretty bolshy and ballsy organisation. I think we bat above our weight. We have similar challenges. You've all seen how pretty Harrogate is, but we're similar to you in that this golden triangle of wealth of accountants and lawyers that work in Leeds but live in Harrogate huge amounts of deprivation in key areas, but also part of a very rural district where population is sparse to super sparse, transport is non-existent, and we've got a responsibility to deliver across quite a big patch, not just across the Harrogate district, but across North Yorkshire. And North Yorkshire, top to bottom, is London to Brighton, east to west, London to Bristol. It's a big patch. So in terms of the work that we have to do, we need to be bold, we need to think big, and we need to leave behind, some of the restraints and some of the things that we've always just done it like that. And yes, we've been through COVID and people have been able to make changes really quickly, but I do think there's a huge amount of people who are just expecting us to be the same old, and that's not going to be, and that's what we're wrestling with as an organisation right now.
Thank you, Sharon, and I know we're going to do some mental health stuff later, which I think is a good thing.
I'm going to go in line of dark and
dream. We have talked about the burnout factor. I wasn't furloughed. I did a 10-year business plan. It was really just quite annoying. But at the same time, I was able to make some changes that I would not have been able to do if we hadn't been through a pandemic. So mental health for us is really important, and we'll do a session on that later. I just wanted to start off with a question for Laurie, actually. So your transformation of the organisation, what did you do in response to COVID and the pandemic? Because it sounds like you were doing all the transformation anyway. It just so happened to be at a time when...
Yeah, I think interesting for us was one of the things that we did, we were 4 weeks into a tour. So we do one main mid-scale tour a year, but it's for 6 months. And we'd done 4 weeks, and we had 5 months just cancelled overnight, even though we had a whole team of actors and crew, 15, on the road. We made the decision to honour all those contracts. So I kind of thought, well, what's a reserve for? Isn't it reserved for dealing with situations like this? We had 15 people who were looking for us, who signed contracts with us. And rightly or wrongly, I got the board to agree to pay everybody's contract through to the end. That meant that I had all these actors sitting around. So I made an agreement with the actors that we would pay their contracts if they all worked on a small film for me, and we created something called Digital Squad. And we had 12 short films on an online platform, and we'd never done anything digital online at all. And then we got a small grant to commission 12 new artists from across the north to make their own. So we had a kind of digital art centre of 25, 26 short films. And from across artists in the north we didn't know before. Some of those artists are now on our board. Some of them are on our newly formed art squad. Some of them we've commissioned for new projects. Some of them made a big outdoor show with young people. In that, you remember that summer where we had that like 3-week gap when things were open, and we managed to kind of sneak in this dance theatre show at the Peace Hall with 25 young people. I don't know how we managed to get away with it without anyone coming down with COVID. But all these things meant that when we recruited our board, we had a completely different kind of awareness out there of what the company did, who we worked with, the kind of work we made. So we got a huge diversity of applications. We did it like 2 years before. We only had one person from the global majority apply the first time around. And other than that, and we only had 6 or 7 applications. This time around, we had about 45 applications. We had a huge proportion from the global majority. And we've now got an amazingly vigorous, arts-focused, diverse board and art squad, which we couldn't have hoped to before. But what I realised is that people had seen the videos and they'd watched the Digital Squad things, and suddenly we were a company that they wanted to be part of. And that was a real lesson to me of, like, first time around trying to appoint a diverse board, we had no success at all. But actually, we changed who we were making work with and for. And actually, it naturally kind of changed our board and our governance structure, and that is now the bedrock for everything going forward, I think.
Brilliant. Thank you, Laurie. Justin, what do you do in November now, other than come to Bathroom?
Well, I might have events, I might not. That's the whole point. You can be flexible. I think broadly we'll have an autumn season, whenever that is. And then we'll broadly have a spring season. There's a summer festival already in the city, so I'm going to steer clear of that period, obviously. I think November is fine.
It all sounds very laid back.
It doesn't feel laid back. No. I mean, I think the thing about relating what's happened in the last 18, 20 months is it all seems very straightforward and clear, and that was how it's going to turn out. I think all of our experiences is that you went from day to day, almost certainly week to week, thinking, what is happening here? What can I do? How do I respond? I had all of those uncertainties and constant changes of direction along the way. I think the thing is that I'm not a large organisation. I'm not employed myself, so there was no furlough. We don't get public funding. And all of those things sort of slightly focus the mind. And I was fortunate in that I'd been in the job for a few years, so I developed relationships with donors and sponsors. So our income is broadly a third box office, a third donations, and a third sponsorship. Sponsorship goes out of the window in a pandemic. Donations should be okay if you look after people and you've got strong relationships. Box office, well, obviously, if you're not putting stuff on, there's none of that. And if you're doing socially distanced, that puts a certain pressure on that. But also, if you're not doing things, it's quite hard to get the donations. So I managed to identify certain corporates, and there were corporates and donors who supported us for all of the previous financial year, when virtually we did no concerts or films. The films came towards the end of that period because I'd been planning a November festival. That obviously went by the way. I then planned something for March, and the board couldn't agree to it because it was all concentrated. And so that was the opportunity for me to say, well, let's spread it out, which is what I've been hoping to do anyway. But the board had resisted that. And so March turned into a spread out June. We thought we'd see how that goes, and then I'd sort of tentatively got some stuff for the autumn. So it may look laid back. That's probably my sort of demeanour, but it's not inside. It's not like that at all. No, it's a churning mess.
In your shed, I believe.
My shed or the kitchen table. Yeah, yeah, it depends. Yeah.
Thank you, Justin. Sharon, just quickly, what's next for HIF?
For us, it was interesting hearing you talk about your 10-year business plan. I always resisted doing anything that was kind of longer than 2 years, partly because of the way that we're funded. We're heavily reliant on sponsorship and ticket sales to 95%. I've got a 350 grand sponsorship income I've got to raise every single year to make the organisation tick over. That's a hefty amount. And when things are on either long or short-term contracts, it makes it really difficult to plan because you've just got to cut something off because the money's gone. You need to swing to the next thing. The next thing I'm doing is a plan on a page, which sounds very local authority and I hate it, but I want something, because we're still on shifting sands, and I don't want to build on shifting sands. I want to build the future. I want something that's going to take me through the next 12 months whilst I'm recruiting, that gives steer direction that we've all bought into for everybody from my chairman right down to my volunteers to understand what we're doing over the next 12 months whilst we rebuild, rethink and go forward. And then we'll be grown up enough to have a 10-year business plan.
Thank you. Right, let's open up to questions. So anybody got a burning question for any of our panel?
Sorry, I always seem to have a question.
That's good.
This is one for Justin in a sense. I remember quite a few years ago, a PAF member at Spitalfields Festival became music at Spitalfields, doing something very much along the lines that I think you're planning. And I just wondered if you've looked into their experience or if you know, sort of 10, 15 years later, how well they're doing, because they diversified away from that focused festival model to an all-round organisation. I just wonder if you lose sponsorship, if you lose focus, or alternatively, if you become an arts organisation year-round.
I think, for me, if I start from the festival perspective, I'd worked in orchestras for two, orchestra management for 20 years, so I came to festivals first in 2012. Before then, I'd done a lot of programming, so that's what led into the festival side, sort of going, I don't know if it's poacher to gamekeeper or vice versa, but it's becoming the promoter. And I sort of thought, well, so what is a festival? And you think, oh, well, it's got to be a celebration, it should take over the town, it should reflect the place, involve young, involve new things. There are all sorts of notions that I had of what it should be. And then when I tried to do it in Cambridge, it didn't work. So yes, I did look around at other models, and I'm aware, you just keep an eye on what's happening. And Spitalfields, as I remember, back in the what I think of as the Judith Sirota years, were, I think they had two festivals, or was it just one even, summer and Christmas. And then I think they went to, and then they started doing some touring and sort of national sort of programs. And then I got the sense that one of those festivals sort of stopped to focus on other things. So for me, the model there is not should I have summer and Christmas or should it be year-round. It's just you can be what you want to be according to your local market. And I don't want to... I was listening to Adam yesterday, the first speaker, the inspiring keynote speaker yesterday, who said, it's not just about ticket sales. Well, his background, as he said, was, subsidised theatre. My background is broadly unsubsidised music. So I worked for the CBSO and ex-cathedra in Birmingham in the 90s, and they're both funded. Since then, I've not had a funded organisation. So for me, ticket sales are key, sponsorships, all those things, and they're all dependent on your local place. So you have to adapt it to that. So I've essentially, my own festival analysis was the problem. I was the problem. And I didn't move quickly enough in the way that Adam yesterday, I think, would have moved. He'd have said, this is the wrong model, change, move on. I recognised that about 5 years ago, but couldn't make it happen. I suspect Adam would have done, but maybe that's just because I'm in awe of the energy. But maybe he's a churning mess as well, but just hides it, the two. But so that's the thing for me, is changing, is not feeling bound up to a model. Because the thing is now with loosening that model is that I talked about women composers and music by sort of other sort of heritages of composer and performers. So we did something with Chinike. Cambridge has a relatively small African and Afro-Caribbean community. It has many, many nationalities, some of whom are there because for study, some who've been born and bred there, some who are refugees, and also a whole mix of things. but it's, you know, the largest population that's non-white, if that's the right phrase. As you can tell, I'm not from the public sector, so I don't always know the right current language, are Chinese. So that's the sort of largest community. So to do something that essentially was focusing more on sort of African and Afro-Caribbean worlds was seen as a little bit perverse. I put Chinookay on. So Chinookay, I can't remember if I said before, is Europe's, as they call themselves, majority black, minority ethnic orchestra. So I brought them. They founded in 2015, but only really got going in 2017. I put them on then in King's Chapel. The idea was you have wrongly marginalised people in the what I would call the musical establishment centre of Cambridge. That's a deliberate, conscious thing. And the audience was completely different, but it was a really hard sell. So it was a challenge for us in marketing terms, but the audience looked completely different, and I don't believe there would have been as that kind of diversity in that chapel ever in its 500 and whatever year history. So that was important. One of the pieces they did that night was by Erilyn Wallen, and she was there. So I commissioned her to write something the following year. And the following year, we put them in the Senate House, which is where the university gives out its degrees. People aren't allowed in there. They don't have concerts. That's another thing. You're getting people into places they can't get to. So all of those things were necessary. But if I'd analysed my market, would I have come up with that necessarily? It's sort of representative, and it's a cliche, I know, but that Henry Ford comment, you know, if you ask people what they want, they'll ask for a faster horse. You know, and he came up with a motor car. It's that sometimes audiences don't know what they want, and you have to sort of show them what's possible. Since then, with Chinookay, they've been back twice more since then. They were back this summer. We sold out. Same sort of arrangement. The key difference I would suggest now is that I don't talk about ethnicity, whether it's the composer, the players, or whatever. I just say, here's some music I think you should hear, and here are some performers I think you should listen to. It's got absolutely nothing to do, you know. So people go along and find out more about George Walker or Florence Price or whoever, you know, Coleridge Taylor, and they went in not perhaps knowing who these people were. So, yeah, I for me, the model, I've gone off-piste now, so apologies, but so going back to your question, who cares what a festival, what I should be? Let's focus on what we want to do, and then we are what we are.
Thank you, Justin. Any more questions from anyone? I think we've got about 8 minutes left. Oh, 4 minutes. Ooh, six. Anyone? No? Okay, brilliant. Thank you, everyone. That's been really insightful. I think it's been good to hear about some of the positive effects of the pandemic and how I know personally how, you know, we've had to change things and adapt to it, and also how we're transforming things. And I'm just wrapping up here, but, you know, I just think we've all got to be the instigators for change. If we want to transform our organisations, if we want to change our name of our festival, if we want to do it different times a year, then let's do it. We've got to be the ones to make that happen. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you.